welcome to the Community Rewatch Podcast. I'm Jen, your host through all things Greendale. And today, it's the study group versus the Germans. That's right, we're talking about alternative history of the German invasion. And I'm very excited to dive into this episode because it is one of the season four episodes that I quite enjoy. And you noticed I said we, and that's because I have two very special first-time guests on this podcast. First up, it's Eric. Hello, Eric.
Hello.
Hi, welcome. And then we have Sherry. Hello, Sherry.
Hello.
Welcome both. I'm excited that you chose this episode because I was a fan of it when it aired and I am a fan of it upon rewatching and cannot wait to dive in. But first, before we do that, let's do what's customary and do our plot recap and our community quotes of the episode. So basically what happens in this episode, if you will recall, the German foosballers from season three have made a grand return to season four. Alas, without Nick Kroll, because he probably had prior commitments and also probably they couldn't afford him. And so we've got a new leader of the German foosballers. The study group is trying to get into they were trying to get into the history of ice cream class, but now they're just in a normal history class. We meet a new professor, Professor Cornwallis, who's going to be teaching them history. And he sets up a point from the beginning that will come back around where he talks about how history is written from the perspective of the victors. And so the study group clashes with the German foosballers naturally. And the German foosballers decide to take over the study room, and the study group is not super happy about that. They did it with the proper paperwork. Study group is still not having it, and so they basically go to war with this group, and you would think that the rest of the school would be on their side, but alas, they are not. And so we kind of learn, are the study group really the heroes that we all see them, or are they actually the villains? And that is what you missed on Community. My Community quotes of the episode. You cannot have a Community quote of the episode and not quote Troy. So here we go. From Troy, if I wanted to know what happened in Europe a long time ago, I'd watch Game of Thrones. God bless Troy. And the other is a dialogue that I very much enjoy where Jeff says, hey, apropos of nothing, what's that sound you make when you see something shocking? And Annie gasps and he goes, oh yeah, that's it. Annie gasps are iconic. So that's what you missed on Community. Welcome to both of you and welcome to season four, everyone. Since this is both of your first times though on the podcast, I wanted to hear a little bit about your Community journey. So Eric, let's start with you. How did you hear about and fall in love with the show?
Well, I was already familiar with Joel McHale because The Soup was on when I was in high school, and my mom, my sister, and I would watch that a lot. And I found out about Community quite by accident because of one joke. It was the scene from Regional Holiday Music when Britta runs up behind Jeff and says, "Jeff, they got Shirley. It's just you and me now." And then he does that kind of like note test. And that scene, for those who don't know, is a parody of the ending of the 1978 version of Invasion of the Body Snatchers, which is one of my favorite horror films. I'm like, oh, that's a funny joke. That looks like a funny show. Might want to get around to watching that, and which I did not do for about 5 years because I procrastinate. The first episode I saw was the one with the Ass Crack Bandit.
A classic.
Which again, I'm not quite sure about it. I was watching Joel McHale do an interview where he was talking about how Chase got fired from the show, and he was talking about the first post Chevy Chase episode, and it was that one. I'm like, oh, that sounds funny. I looked it up. It was funny. I'm like, I might want to watch the rest of the show, which I still didn't do for a couple of years. And then finally it showed up on Netflix, and I went through it last year. And I think it hooked me once we got to Modern Warfare. And since then, it's just become one of my favorite shows of all time. I've rewatched it three times.
Nice.
Just since last year. So you can tell I'm a fan.
Yeah.
But yeah, so, you know, thank you, Netflix. I got the series on Blu-ray. It's nice. Just wonderful, wonderful, great characters. And since I'm a lot like Abed, and then I'm a pop culture encyclopedia, I pick up on all the references, and I just love how meta the show gets and how creative it gets, and like paying homage to things like war documentaries, horror films, etc.
Yeah. Well, that's exciting. That's cool. I definitely love that so many people knew Joel from The Soup. That is how I went into the show, was like, I knew two actors, and it was Joel McHale from The Soup, and it was Yvette Nicole Brown from Drake and Josh. And I was like, well, I know those two and I like them, so maybe I'll like this show and give it a shot. So I do hear a lot that Modern Warfare is the one that hooks people. And so it's a good one to get hooked by for sure, that in season one. So Sherry, how about you? How did you hear about and get into Community?
So what year did it premiere?
2009.
Okay, so it was 2009.
That was a long time ago. I feel like this last couple of years have felt like 10 years, so 2009 feels like an entirely different lifetime.
A different life. I was a totally different person. So it is what it is. Were. But I still love Community. So I had just started checking out Parks and Rec because Amy Poehler is just about flawless. And I was probably just too lazy to change the channel, and Community came on next. And it was Football, Feminism, and You.
Yay. And that's my episode.
And what stuck with me watching it was there's a scene, and I haven't seen the episode in a while, but there's a scene where Jeff is basically telling Annie to do the right thing. And they're like outside walking. And I remember thinking, oh my God, a TV show character is making like a moral plea. Like, I hadn't seen that on TV in so long. And again, this was 2009, and the 2000s, in my opinion, were just a mess. And nowadays, everybody takes a stand. Everybody has something that they want to say, but it was just groundbreaking. I was like, I can get in line with this show. And fortunately I did, because it's so clever. And so just everything is just the dialogue and the edits and just everything. And I was just there for the whole ride through season three. And then I forget what happened, but I somehow didn't have network television anymore. And so I kind of missed season four. And I figured it wasn't a big deal because Dan Hammer wasn't there. And then I picked it back up season five and so on. So that's how I got introduced to it. And I've been with it, you know, as much as possible ever since.
Nice. I like that. That's my hook episode for me, was Football, Feminism, and You. It's still one of my favorite episodes, still one that I go back to that I'm like, if I need a good laugh, it usually is like one of the ones that I go to and put on. Cause even though I can quote most of it, I'm just like, it's still fun. Like the Troy and Jeff conversation on the football field is the first time I ever laughed out loud in the show. And I was like, I get it now.
Yes, exactly.
This is good. This is going to be good.
Did they just say that? Oh yes. My God.
The rapport, the back and forth. I was just like, oh, I can see how they're going to play off of all the comedic beats that these actors have. Right. And you can totally see how they did that as the show progressed. Like they were like, okay, Donald Glover like has massive comedic chops, like let's use him, like let's use all these characters in what they're good at comedically, whether it's like physical or line delivery or whatever. So I appreciate that. Well, I mean, speaking of season four is a contentious one. It's the one that I feel like I hear a lot of people chit chat about. They love it, they hate it. I've found a lot more people fall into the middle ground of like, it's fine, it's okay. So I wanted to get both of your general thoughts on Community's fourth season overall. What are your thoughts on it? Where do you fall in that spectrum?
I can definitely see why a lot of people, you know, rank this as their least favorite season, because you can sort of tell that Harmon isn't there. The writing isn't quite as subtle or witty. And there are episodes that do, you know, feel more like Community fan fiction as opposed to, you know, just being Community, but it's good Community fan fiction. You know, yes, this season does have the most amount of episodes that I do not like, but it also has ones that are really good, like the one we're talking about today, the Freaky Friday episode, which was actually written by the actor who played Dean Pelton. That's a great episode, and I actually like Advanced Introduction to Finality. I think that's a good finale to the season.
Okay, good. I'm gonna talk to Matt about that, because our friend Matt from Communities is slated to come on, and I'm like, you know, everyone dogs on this episode, and I don't hate it. I don't know why. It's like, am I like in a fever? Like, am I the only person who actually enjoys this episode? So, I mean,
I liked it a lot.
Fair, to direct quote Megan Gans, the writer of the episode, when she came onto our pod over the summer, she said, I will come onto this other episode that I wrote in season four, but I don't know that I can quote unquote defend the finale. But honestly, Megan,
yes, she can.
Yes,
she
I like can. It. I enjoy it. So thank you for saying that, Eric. Yeah.
There's a lot to like about this season. It's the last season that has all of the main cast. I like a lot of the characters in here. I like Professor Cornwallis a lot.
That's where we're disagreeing right now. But that's okay. We'll talk about that.
I'm a big fan of Malcolm McDowell.
He's great. He's great. I hate the character. He's wonderful.
I love to hate him.
Okay.
I like the character because he's an asshole.
Okay.
and some of the criticisms that I've heard, you know, are kind of unfair. Like, a lot of people, apparently Bill Murray was one of the people who was in the running to play Jeff's dad, and people were disappointed that James Brolin got the part. And I'm like, they still got the father of Thanos from the MCU. Yeah. That's not something you complain about.
Yeah. I think, to be fair, part of that, I think, was that, like, Dan never wanted to actually put, from what I remember reading, and I do not quote me on where I found this, because Matt from Communities would probably know. But, like, I remember reading somewhere that, like, Dan had originally never, like, wanted that to actually, like, Jeff to actually meet his dad. Like, he was just going to be this elusive figure that you never really see. So I can see why it works to do that. But I can also see why it really works, because, again, cooperative escapism and familial relations, I think Joel knocks that episode out of the park. Like, that's one of Joel's best performances to me, is in that scene where he's confronting his dad. So, like, You get the good and the bad. But Sherry, what are you? I feel like you and I were on the same page too, as far as season four, and specifically some of the seasons that come after season four.
So I'm the super annoying person on Twitter who, every time season four is mentioned, I'm like, it was amazing, and everybody needs to realize that. So you guys eventually just stop replying to me. So what happened was, I didn't have Never Television for a while. I just had my Roku, and I was like, no big deal. Dan Harmon's gone. Everybody's saying the season sucks. I'm probably not missing anything. And then when I finally was able to go back and I wanted to watch it before I caught up with season five, I was just like, I've just felt so betrayed, because it was so good. It was just so good. And even now when I go back and watch it, I'm like, this is so good.
Yeah.
And I just avoided a cuss word there, so be glad. I just think, and again, we've all said, you know, it's got its high points, its midpoints, its low points. Every season does. I think the puppet episode is probably has the funniest moment of the entire series for me in it, when
I'm really excited because I notoriously hate that episode, which I know people fall on this spectrum of, they either love it or they hate it.
I love it so much. And when the Jeff puppet has a little whip and the Dean takes it off, I die. I cannot think of a funnier thing to witness in my life than that, because it's so perfect. But anyway, I actually didn't like the I hope you can't hear that thunder. I didn't actually like the episode where Jeff met his dad. It took me a while to get into it. I loved the final paintball. Mm-hmm. I just felt like, and I even thought, like, it's so cute. Like, we all want to, I would hope that we would all want a Greendale Babies cartoon at some point.
Heck yeah.
And I can see what you're saying, Eric, about, like, it's a little bit of a fan fiction kind of thing, but, like, it's good fan fiction. Like, who doesn't want to see baby Jeff in a diaper? So that's how I feel.
Yeah.
And I just because I'm going to come back to this, I felt like the fans really did just kind of pile on in deference to Dan Harmon, which is understandable, but I really want to make sure that the people who were still there hanging on and trying to make a good product get their props, because I think they did a fantastic job. And I am so glad that I really appreciate everything that they did, because it had to have been difficult.
Yeah. I mean, that's the one thing that I talk a lot about, and Chelsea and I do, because we are notorious season four defenders, is, like, you know, you can tell that there are some episodes, and the people who are making the show would definitely tell you that it was really hard, and that it was difficult to not have Dan there to kind of, as they would say, harmonize, like, the scripts and do that, because that was what he did. And I always go back to that too, of like the cast, and especially like Megan Ganz, Andy Bobrow, all of the writers who had stuck around, because there was such a high turnover rate too. There were new writers who came on in season four. They had new showrunners. Like, it was, and I mean, the cast stuck it out, and it was, that was, I think, one of the things that like, I want to, again, Sherry, like constantly go back to, is like the people who stayed and made this, it, they were in a lose-lose situation to begin with. And like, for, please do not like, you know, just give it a shot. It doesn't have to be your favorite season, but like, remember that these people like didn't have to stay, like they didn't have to stay there making this thing for us, and they did. And that was why I was so defensive of it, was like, I love the people who are staying to make this. And this is so important that like, we acknowledge that this was a really hard thing for them to do, and they're making art for us still, even though it's difficult. And, you know, it's not, like I said, it's not all bad. Like, I loathe some episodes in season six, and that is a season where Dan was there. I also loathe an episode or two in this one and in season five. There are some in season I've never
season
watched. Season one. Like, you know, I think to pick up on, you know, for a lot of people, it was like, if it hadn't come out that like Dan was leaving, I think people would have felt like maybe there was something off, but it wouldn't have gotten as vehemently against the season from the get-go that people
my theory is that if you sat someone down who didn't know anything about Community and had them watch seasons 1 through 4 and then be like, which season was Dan gone, they'd be like, I didn't know Dan left. That's my theory,
we did an episode where we did our Community newbies versus vets, where my friend Cor and I sat down with two of our friends who just binge watched it for the first time in 2020, and they said, we didn't tell them anything. We didn't tell them like Dan's leaving, like, you know, all this. And there's another podcaster, the Welcome to Greendale podcast, that they have they're watching with someone who's watching for the first time. And I'm very curious to hear her thoughts, but also for my friends, they were kind of like, well, we noticed something was a little different, but like, what happened during that season? So like, they went in and they kind of maybe felt like something was off, but there was not the, oh, this is garbage, like, this is the worst thing ever, like,
what the hell happened?
Exactly. So, and I mean, now obviously we'll talk about it as we continue to talk about season four, as things came out later on about Dan Harmon. I've talked about this and I will talk about it. It's very complicated. Like, there's, you know, Dan created a great thing, but is not a great person. And so that is something that you have to reckon with when you watch these things. And for me, watching season four, it gives me a little bit of, it definitely gives me, not a little bit, it gives me way more appreciation for the people who were working on the show from seasons 1 through 3. And then in season four, got the chance to do more and craft more and create more and all that. So thank you both for sharing your thoughts on season four. I'm interested to hear from all of the rest of our guests as how they feel as we continue to talk about it. But we're talking about alternative history of the German invasion. And this episode relies heavily on the theme, history is written by the victors. And the whole episode revolves around us rethinking the idea of the study group as the heroes of the show, since to the other characters, they're the villains. First up, do you think that they're the villains in this episode? Why or why not?
Yes. Absolutely yes.
Done. End of podcast. We did it. Good job, guys. Covered everything. All right, good.
The big issue with the study group, and I think it's an issue that a lot of people have for various reasons, is they kind of live in a bubble. And if you get stuck in your bubble so much, you're not going to see how you're affecting other people. Because the funny thing is, I actually bought into it when I first watched the episode. Like, I thought, oh, these exaggerated German stereotypes, how dare they sit in a room and study, bastards.
Yes, how dare they sit at a table in a community college that is literally for them to sit at and study.
But then you watch the episode and they don't do anything unreasonable. Mm-mm. They don't do anything malicious. Yes, they're a little bit theatrical and how they do it, but that's it. Yeah. And there can be a little bit of debate on how much of that is real and how much of that is just in the heads of, you know, your protagonists. And then, you know, the study group, you know, they start to, you know, complain, oh, we have to use these other study rooms that are awful. And then you go back and rewatch the episode and you're like, oh, that's what everybody else on campus has had to use ever since the beginning of the show, because they keep hogging that one room.
Yeah.
So really the only thing that they have to put up with is what everybody else on campus has had to put up with for the last couple of years. And they completely overreact. They never try to talk with them and say, hey, can we arrange, you know, study times with you guys at some point, you know, figure out what time is good for you, what time is good for us. They never do that. They go straight to, they go straight towards an episode of Hogan's Villains. By the way, that's my favorite joke of the episode, is the Hogan's Villains joke. That's the line that I keep laughing at from this episode.
Oh, and so good.
But the episode does a great job at fooling you into making you think they're the heroes, until the moment that they go back to the study room and everybody else on campus is like, yeah, you guys are jerks.
Yeah. It's it's the same kind of treatment that we get with every show that we watch, right? Like, we have the friends have their couch, and McLaren's pub has a specific booth for our friends from How I Met Your Mother. Like, and they do those occasional, like, someone else is sitting in our spot kind of jokes. And they do it as obvious meta commentary that, like, these people are always here, but this actually is not something that they own. It's not their couch. They've just claimed it as their spot. And so what I loved so much about watching this episode, what I love so much about rewatching it, is that I love that the study group gets their comeuppance, because they are a codependent bunch of, like, jerks in this episode. And like you said, Eric, they're not saying, oh, okay, like, can we at least split it? Like, can we come in at this time? You use it this time. They're not being reasonable about it. They jump to thing doing pretty quickly. And that thing is, like, we are the victims. They are trying to take our home away from us. And we deserve this, which is a very interesting place to approach their table and their room, is like, well, we deserve it, because it's ours, because it's always been ours. So that's why we should have it. And it's really fun to watch them, like, lose, and to have them be like, reckon with the idea that, like, the rest of the school hates you guys, because it is a nice little meta, like, what if we actually saw what Greendale was like from a perspective other than the study group? Like, they're awful. They take up so much unnecessary time.
Especially to poor Todd.
Oh, Todd. Poor Todd. Todd and his baby and his turtle.
I was going to say that a couple episodes before was when he had, like, cracked.
Yeah.
Like, yes. It was the episode, and he was like, what is wrong with you people?
You guys, your love is toxic and weird. And they were terrible to him. And we were supposed to, like, that's funny. It's funny because we're supposed to, like, look at Todd as like, oh, this, how dare Todd be this way? But at the end of that episode, we talked about it when we talked about it with our friend Jillian. We were like, the study group doesn't learn their lesson at the end of their competitive ecology. They learn nothing. They blame Todd still for all their problems. So as we get to season four, what has our group learned right before the conclusion of this episode? Absolutely nothing.
So here are my thoughts. Eric, I think you laid it out really well, because it's all about perspective. And I hadn't thought about it until you said it, but the Germans really didn't do anything wrong.
Nope.
they signed out the room.
All they wanted to do was study. Right. And
I want to go on the record and say that, and I don't know if I'm going to say his name right, but Chris Diamantopoulos, or I think that's the name. Anyway, the one who played Reinhardt, probably my favorite, like, character on it, just ever. Like, I think he was amazing. I think the Germans were adorable. But I still was like, but they're the villains, right? Mm-hmm. I personally do not see the Greendale Seven as the pure villains in this episode. I think it's a little, just a tiny, not a lot, just a tiny bit more complex than that. When you think about how they first saw the group in this, they were in the library room, but they weren't at their study table. And they were like, what's going on? And they're like, what are you talking about? The Germans didn't purposely got there early to take their table. So it was kind of an antagonism.
They were definitely being petty.
Yeah. And I mean, it's the greatest thing to show. Like, yeah. When the group has to keep getting up earlier and earlier. It's like earlier, it's like 8:30 and they're just like drove, like they can't do it, which is how I am at 8:30.
Yeah.
Not to get too like philosophical, but it kind of makes me think about how, you know, the study group was kind of there first. Mm-hmm. And I mean, like you could go back to the beginning of Greendale in like, who knows, like 1897, but like the study group was there and then they were being pushed out. So it's kind of like, you know, how does that play out in real history? Like what happens when somebody's quote unquote there first and then mm-hmm. somebody else comes and tries to edge their way in? I mean, the people who are already there are going to be upset. They don't want to change. And so it's hard for me to see Greendale as the villains, but I do think the episode on the whole is good for the reflection of, let's look at it from both sides. And I love how they show like the pen episode from Garrett's point of view. It's great. It's great.
I know. Like I had something to do. And I think that's the thing is like, you know, one of the things that I always talk about with community that I love when we see these kinds of episodes, and this ranks pretty low for a lot of people, but I think it's one of the ones that works best in conveying this concept of like, Greendale is about more than just the study group. And we always see it from their perspective. And the reality is that they are very codependent and self-centered. Like, and if they don't, and we're all like that. Like, that's the thing is like, we all can be very self-involved, but the study group, when they're all together, they tend to like elevate those negative qualities as well uh-huh. as like the positive ones. So you get the fact that like, oh, they have no clue that other people need to study in other buildings and other rooms that are not as nice as the one that they're in. That just doesn't even cross their mind. It doesn't even cross their mind that like someone else should or could share the space. It's just like, no, automatically. But it is interesting because we'll kind of talk a little bit about it, I guess. But like, I like that you showed different perspectives. Like Annie was more lenient at first. She was more willing to kind of compromise, and Jeff is automatically like distrusting. No, they only have bad motives and this. And yeah, of course they're cartoonishly like antagonistic and petty. It's also real funny, like that they just keep getting there
right.
earlier and still be the study group. But I like that the study group has to reckon with the fact that like they thought they were going to be celebrated by the rest of the school. Like, yeah, we're victorious. We righted a wrong. Look at us. We're the model students, because we know Dean Pelton loves them. We saw that in the flashback episodes. Dean Pelton loves them and elevates them more than any other group. That would really be awful if you went to Greendale. So right. seeing those little vignettes of like, them being like, I have projects to do. I have to do things. They've been in there because there's a pen went missing for right. hours. It's like the moment where they're like, well, they're still trying to rationalize it too. Like, no, uh-huh. no, we're not bad. Come on, guys. Like, we're not the bad guys.
And it's interesting for me again, because I don't, maybe I'm falling into a trap where it's like, okay, here we have a sitcom and we have our main characters, and it's really hard to have a successful sitcom where you absolutely hate the main characters. Yeah. So we all love them,
yeah. you know,
and we're on their side. Yeah. And I'm probably on their side when they do ridiculous stuff the most, because I'm kind of sure. like too meta, like it's the script called for it.
Yeah.
Like nobody would really do this. But I think it's also a good point about like representation. Like if all we ever see is their perspective, even when it gets wonky, I'm still like, yeah, we're cool. But everybody else is like, it's not cool. So it's kind of an interesting, and that's why I just think this episode just hits on just all the cylinders, because yeah. I mean, it really, and maybe even the writers didn't, you know, mean for it to come out that way, but like, I see it as a kind of, for myself, as a commentary on representation, because the other people are around for comedic gags. They're not full real people. Mm-hmm. And this episode is kind of like, but they are. And I'm like, but how? So it's just, you know.
Yeah. It's funny because that idea doesn't get fleshed out a lot in shows. Like, right. Like we just assume that literally, you know, the friends can just sit on the couch and that's their couch and no one else should ever be sitting on it. And no one else ever is.
That's what we've always seen.
Because that's the way we've always seen it. And it would be weird if it happened, because it does happen a couple times. And it is weird that you're like, why is someone else sitting there? Why is someone else sitting in the booth? And literally there's a whole storyline in How I Met Your Mother about them trying to get the yeah. girls out of the booth that are sitting in their booth.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, why can't you just go to another booth or another table?
Because it's our booth.
Because it's our booth. And like that idea is really funny to explore and unpack in, because no other episode does it as fully as this one did.
Right.
And I think another point worth mentioning is that we learn that they weren't the only ones who missed the puppy parade. Poor Todd and Garrett missed the puppy parade, and there needs to be justice.
Justice for Todd and Garrett. Justice for
Always.
Todd. Poor Todd.
Always.
But
always.
I mean, you make a great point, Sherry, of like this idea that shows that this episode unpacks of like, background characters to you are still real people, and there are real I think the biggest takeaway is that there are real consequences to their real actions, and the speaker doesn't often have to face real lasting consequences for their actions. They kind of just get wrapped up within 20 some minutes because this is a sitcom, so of course they do. But this episode was a great one to kind of look at, like, what would happen if we took a step back and saw like what their actions actually are doing to the other fully formed characters at Greendale. Cause we did get a taste of that with like Todd. Todd has a kid and a turtle, and he has a life that he needs to get back to. And they were basically holding him hostage because they couldn't figure out how to pair up for their project. So, I mean, I like that this unpacks a lot of those things, and it does it in a way where I'm like, you know, at the end of the day, do I think the study group is the villains of their story? No, but do I feel like they had to reckon with the fact that they're not always the heroes, and that the only reason sometimes they are the heroes is because they have more power? For sure.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Everyone is the hero of their own story.
Yeah.
And it's always going to be that way. And the best we can hope for is to give them some perspective.
Exactly. Well, there's a little alliance that forms. What did you all think of Carl's little alliance with Abed throughout the episode and the study group members' responses to the war for the study room / their responses to the Germans in general? I love Abed and Carl's little friendship.
It's beautiful.
Pure.
I may be reading too much into it, but I always thought that maybe it was a reference to the Christmas armistice of 1914. You guys know about that?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
It deals with similar themes to the Pillows and Blankets episode, where, you know, although it deals with them in a slightly different way. But yeah, I mean, basically, because of this conflict, Abed, you know, is made to spoil what could be a new friendship. And I find that sad. And you know, he's one of the few members of the group who initially, you know, starts to see, you know, maybe we're going too far with this. Because again, Abed is one of the people who relies on their better angels a little bit more than some of the other characters do. And yeah, like this incredibly stupid conflict over how dare these people want to learn in this room. It wrecks it, you know, perhaps indefinitely. And that's something that I always found a little bit sad.
Yeah.
But it works.
Yeah. I mean, I like that. Well, and Abed is one of the few characters who actually reckons with what they did, whereas you see, and we'll talk about it towards the end, of like what the study group learns, or what their process of rationalizing what they've done or learned or was supposed to learn, all in the name of maybe a lesson from Cornwallis, quote unquote. I like that Abed is the person who, when other characters are trying to rationalize, is like, no, that was wrong. I shouldn't have done that. Like, that was what he basically was like, no, there was no reason for me to have done that. Like, he saved my life in a game and I turned around and like betrayed him. That's not right.
And of course, Troy says, you were just following orders.
Yes. So, and that's just an interesting little commentary on Abed, of like this idea, because the show, a lot of times I don't like that the show does is that it presents Abed in so many different kind of caricature-y ways when it wants to, of like, Abed doesn't know real from fiction. Abed can't tell the difference between this. Abed is a robot. But like this nuance of like Abed knows right from wrong, and he won't let someone rationalize him into thinking like I was doing the right thing when I was actually doing the wrong thing. Like that was important because all the other characters, as we tend to see, get very swept up in emotions and rousing winger speeches, and they can kind of let themselves be taken away by that. Poor Shirley is just like, I didn't want to do this from the beginning. And
I want to go home.
I just wanted to go home, and I'm begrudgingly doing this. Whereas some of the other characters in this episode, like Annie, kind of get caught up in the emotion of it, of like feeling right, like feeling vindicated and that kind of stuff. And so I felt sad for Abed.
I thought that, like I said, I thought that their immediate friendship was just beautiful. And I just want to say that the actor that plays Carl is super hot. So that also helps. He could do no wrong, obviously. But you know, it's kind of like, again, like all you have to do is find that one link between you that's this, you know, similar or the same. You know, I like this and you like it too. Or we're both a part of this group. And it's like, there was no, oh, I shouldn't talk to you. They actually like, it was kind of like a handshake, kind of like one of those, you know, arm shakes. And it was just that simple. And so I think again, a really good commentary on how it's much harder to hate the quote unquote other once you humanize them, once you have something, you know, something about them that relates back to you, because then they become people and it's harder to treat them badly. And which is why both when Abed goes along with Oktoberfest and, you know, like regular Germans went along with like the Nazis in World War II, it's devastating because it's still possible, even when you love someone or even when you have a good friend, it's still possible to turn against them. So it's like, you know, we have good and we have bad, and it just goes back and forth.
Yeah. Yeah, the moral compass of the study group isn't always set at due north. And I think that they're just, it's interesting because of the fact that they all get on board this conflict for very different reasons. I feel like most of the group just kind of gets caught up with Jeff. And Jeff is the one from the very beginning who's like, people cannot be trusted. They have something up their sleeve. And he convinces the rest of the group that they do. And the truth is like, yeah, they were being kind of petty about it. But like Eric said, all they wanted to do was study. Like they were going to war because they felt like they were like, well, I want to study. I'm not like, I need to stand up to this group. And it's funny because that is what comes back around at the end, is like the rest of our side characters being like, someone stood up to you for the first time and you basically treated them like garbage and blackmailed them. And that's not okay. Cause like, are you saying you're going to do that to us too, or that you have the right to do that to us? So it's very interesting because I feel like Annie at the very beginning is interesting to watch because she really does want to like concede, as she doesn't want conflict. Like she's like, oh, well, we should just let them share that table. Like, it's fine. It's fine. Whatever.
That was a really good imitation, by the way.
Thank you. I am Annie at heart. Fine, whatever. But they, you know, but Jeff has a way of talking the group into doing things that they don't necessarily want to do, but sound right. Right. Like, yeah. I mean, that's how he gets them to do things in season 5 and the premiere. He gets them to like sign the papers that they need to sign because he's good at playing on emotions, and emotions are what drive the study group into doing a lot of what they do collectively. And so
Jeff is absolutely a demagogue, especially in this episode.
Yeah.
You know, like it's interesting because in Pillows and Blankets, you know, Pillows and Blankets shows how much of an opportunist he is when he really, really doesn't care about what's going on. But in this episode, he really gets into it, and he's really kind of rallying up the base to go to war over the dumbest reason. and yeah, like I got caught up in it when I first saw the episode. That's the scary thing.
Yeah, Jeff.
Yeah,
Winger.
Exactly.
Winger speech. Yeah.
Because yeah, well, I mean, we'll go into it more once we get to the next point.
It's just, he's so good at like, he's so good at escalating things. Speaking of escalation, as the episode progresses, I really do enjoy segueing through these points, people. Like, I just, if you have a favorite segue, I would like to hear it. Anyway, so as the episode does progress, though, we see that the study group escalates. So it starts off with, like, we're just going to try and get there early. We're going to do things the right way. We're going to sign out the study room table, whatever. But it escalates to literally like blackmailing the students out of the study room and kicking them out in a very elaborate Oktoberfest just to get the room back because they felt it was rightfully theirs. So let's talk about that, shall we? How do you feel like this escalation worked overall?
Yeah, again, you know, it worked for me because, you know, upon first watching the episode, I was pulled into it. I was on Jeff's side here, and I felt bad for the group. It's like, oh, now they're getting stuck in these horrible study rooms with broken chairs, and how dare these incredibly funny Germans want to learn?
How dare they go learn in another room? This is the community this set.
This may not be related, but the episode does kind of use some kind of xenophobic tendencies to get you on Jeff's side, because if you replace Germans in his dialogue with any other group,
right?
Oh my God. Yeah. And then you suddenly realize how horrible everything that he's saying really is. And they do definitely try to play up German stereotypes on the group to make you dislike them more. Mm-hmm. And given portrayals of Germans as villains in a lot of popular media, you know, you fall for it. Mm-hmm. You fall for it. And so when you watch the group kind of escalate their tactics, it does, you do kind of get pulled into it. That's one of the things about the episode that I honestly find a little bit unsettling. As for the escalation, it's interesting because they go way too hard, way too fast, but that's kind of the point.
Yeah.
So they try to get to the study room early. They don't, and then immediately Jeff's like, let's ruin these people's lives.
Yeah. We need a ruse.
Let's drop the nuclear bomb on the city and level it.
It's
and
just
again, no negotiation, no talk at all. Just they try to get up a little bit earlier. And then that doesn't work out. So Oktoberfest. You know,
but it goes back to what we have said, or what I said is like, Jeff immediately starts from a posture of, I cannot trust you. Like, and he does that in life. And so when he goes 0 to 60 in like a, you know, Annie has like a, we should give them the benefit of the doubt thing. And he goes, no, they cannot be trusted from the very beginning. When you start from a place of whatever, this person cannot be trusted, you do not come back from that place. You only escalate into, and like you said, Eric, it goes very quickly to like, there's no middle ground. There's, let's plan an elaborate ruse to blackmail these students and have this plan to do all of this so that we can get our study room table back and they feel good about it too, which is like the...
Yeah. And it's funny because I had to go back and really think about, because I agree. I was like, you know, they really pulled out all the stops in like 2.5 seconds. So I had to go back and really think about it. And it's the scene, which again, it's one of my favorite scenes, where they're in their makeshift study room and the chairs just start breaking and they all fall down. And so it's kind of like a metaphorical breaking point, if you will. And of course, I love how Abed's the last and just like, this is happening, and he just lets it happen because he's Abed, and it's perfect. But I went back and I was like, maybe that, because a lot of times I try to think, you know, again, we're working within time constraints. And I think when you take out the commercials, you know, you're really dealing with 20, 21 minutes. Yeah. So I try to give the writers the benefit of the doubt that they can't spend too much time escalating, especially when the Oktoberfest was so full of so many amazing gags. And it's like, so I felt like they tried to get it. Tried to give it a reason for people to go back to and say, well, they had reached a breaking point. I can kind of see that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and we know that the study group doesn't do anything halfway. They are full speed ahead. But it's funny because we're so used to seeing that full speed ahead be shenanigans and really funny things. And we're on their side, like you said, Sherry. We're like, oh, we're along for the ride. We're on board with this. Of course, you're going to flip over desks and turn over a study room to try and find a pen. We're on board with this. It makes sense. It tracks. But what's interesting that I have always talked about is that in season two, you have like the group often at war with each other, but then you hit a point where the group gets hella codependent, and then it's the group versus everyone. Like it's the group and the others. And so like, and we see that here,
I don't know if especially. This has been mentioned because we're on season four. So somebody's probably said this before now, but once they turn codependent, they do not date outside the group anymore for the rest of the show. For the rest of the series. Yeah. And I think it's really, really telling. And it happened somewhere around season three.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah. They go 0 to 60 for shenanigans and we think it's funny. And then they go 0 to 60 in this episode. And it's like, it's funny, but then you're like, oh no, like this is bad. Like now we're seeing what your shenanigans do to other people and why you felt the need to go from 0 to 60 so quickly and to really like do an all-out war for the table. And we know, of course, that the table is magic and it has we know that the table, they've been through a lot with the table, but at the same time there is this like sense of insecurity of this group. Like they're codependent, right? Like they're super codependent. So when they're codependent, they cannot be without each other. And they feel like their foundation is so fragile that if they don't have the study room, that it is an injustice akin to whatever the biggest injustice they can think of is. And everyone's out to get them. And they, it's them versus everyone else. It's them versus the world. And so we
they're
see
like having
that,
an identity
though.
Crisis, yeah. Basically. They, yeah. The table is their
the
life.
The table is them.
The table is them. Yeah. And that's a really good point.
Yeah. So it's, but it is interesting because we do talk about this. They go very, very quickly. They then get, they get put in their place after this Oktoberfest. So this Oktoberfest was an elaborate ruse, obviously, to get some sanctioned events that Dean Pelton doesn't want any sort of culture celebrated. So that is against Greendale policy.
We frown upon anyone celebrating their own culture, something like that, which is classic.
Which is like classic Greendale.
Classic Greendale.
But I mean, the moment, like, and we can talk about it a little bit more, the moment outside the study room is the moment that the group actually like comes to the they have to be faced with the realization that even though the Greendale Seven love each other in a codependent and toxic way and are beloved by Dean Pelton, they are not beloved by the rest of the school. What did you think of the fact that the show decided to use this particular moment as that evidence? And what did you think of the quote unquote flashbacks that we get, including the one that I'm like, I don't even want to know what this was about. I guess I couldn't even guess this ice skating thing. What is happening? Though Joel McHale can rock those eyelashes. I mean, you know, those were real fun.
So I was going to mention them. And if you've ever seen Jim Carrey's The Grinch, which I've seen a million times, those are the eyelashes. And he just looks like a who. And I'm just like,
stop. Yes, you're so right. I did not even make that connection. That is
it's adorable. Now. Again.
All right.
Yeah, like that was one of the most impactful seasons for me on season four, because it is a moment of not only the group's, you know, self-realization, but it's your realization as an audience that you've been following these people that aren't necessarily bad people. They're just very oblivious to everyone else.
Yeah.
I think that's their big crime. I don't think any of them are horrible people, except maybe Pierce. But
Pierce is a horrible person. I will say that. I stand on this hill.
I don't know.
Yeah, but you're right.
That they're not bad people, but they're oblivious. Mm-hmm. And when you're oblivious, it makes you apathetic to everyone else. And that makes you unintentionally cruel. And that's what they've been. They've been unintentionally cruel. And yeah, were they trying to help Neil out with the D&D game? Yes. Did you have to use that study room? Not really. The pen fiasco was ridiculous.
Yes.
And again, with that, those lipstick eyelashes and roller skates.
It's just, I don't know. What happened?
That felt like something from the earlier flashback episode where they were showing stuff that we hadn't seen. It's like, okay.
Please tell me the story of this though.
I want to know how Pierce got on his, was forced to his knees in front of a Mexican drug cartel. And I also want to know what the hell happened there.
Yeah. Right?
Like, I want to know what point this is.
What point was Jeff trying to make, and how was he doing a warrior speech with this to make his point?
It looks like something that the dean would have put on.
Right.
So maybe he was trying to teach the dean a lesson.
It feels like he had to go over and above to his usual.
He was not ice skating. Yeah, Let's just get that out of the way.
Nah, it was a metaphor for something. But I mean, you're right, Eric. Like the idea that their obliviousness and the fact that like in a normal show, we wouldn't pick up on that. We just see the characters as heroes because they're our heroes. They're the people we follow around. We don't really care about the people who are in the background. And that's even more true of like things like Friends and How I Met Your Mother, which are the examples earlier, because really that's just the group. It's just the group and occasionally other people pop into it. But unlike Greendale, there's no consistent characters that are also being impacted by whatever the group is doing. So so you've got like the study group, and then you've got other characters who are taking classes, who we've seen, who we've met through these other classes. And so we care about them because we've seen them. But if you don't see the people around you, if you're oblivious, if you've got your head down and all you care about is the people that you're with, well, then you're not going to be able to look and actually address like what they talk about at the end, like the problems that are around them. Because they're oblivious not just to people, but to problems that are happening in the school. And they see them initially as inconveniences for them rather than problems that other people are facing, right? Like they see the study groups that they're in or the study rooms that they're in as how inconvenient that we have to sit in a room where there's something that's dead in the vent or a faulty light or rickety chairs. How dare we have to endure this? But instead of focusing on that, obviously towards the end, they realize like, oh, it's not fair that other people have to go through this. Like we've been thinking about what we don't like. We haven't been thinking about what other people actually go through. Which is why, I don't think that they're bad people necessarily at their core, except for Pierce. But I do think that they are, you're right, Eric, when you become oblivious, you become apathetic. There's no empathy. And when you don't have empathy, you can't care about the problems or people that are around you because you don't see them. You refuse to look and acknowledge what's happening. So
I don't really have much to add about that scene. I think you guys said it all. I remember it was really refreshing when I first saw it. I was like, this makes sense.
You guys are right. You poor people who have had to endure this for years. You were Garrett. Like, oh, dang it. They
Garrett.
Poor Garrett.
Yeah, poor Garrett. We gotta save Garrett.
Save him. Didn't we already save him?
Did we?
Did we?
I think the only thing, this is just a nitpick for me. In an otherwise practically perfect episode, is that I felt like the characters in the scene spelled out what was already very obvious. I felt like they didn't have to go, oh my God, we're the Germans.
Yeah.
It's like, yes, we get it.
That was the one thing that I was like, that we didn't need that extra line of dialogue. Yeah, I was like,
is that for the kids?
We've gotten it for the entire episode. When you do this very elaborate analogy.
Yes.
I do agree with you there. That was a nitpick of mine too. It's like, we don't have to say it. We know it. We get it. We're all thinking it.
I mean, I like the line, oh my God, all this time we thought the Germans were the Germans, but we're the Germans. I like that line. I just didn't think they had to keep going because that line alone was
great.
Like, okay, you said a funny line.
Done.
Let that be the end of it and move on.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you're going to spoil a really good punchline.
And that line is also indicative of their perspective, because mm-hmm. German still equals bad. Mm-hmm. So it just matters who's wearing the German mantle. And mm-hmm. it's like, okay, but you haven't quite learned the lesson yet.
Yeah. You're right. So what did you think about the way that this episode kind of resolved with Jeff's speech and the group learning their lesson? Obviously, at first, the group thinks that it's some sort of elaborate ruse concocted by their professor, who's like, why would someone do that to teach 6-7 people a lesson? Does it
happen a lot? And that's one of my favorite moments with Cornwallis. Yes, he's horrible.
Yeah.
But he's totally right in that scene. That is a ridiculous idea.
It's a ridiculous concept that he's like, how is this a thing that actually happened? And of course, that's what I love about that scene, is like the group is trying to let themselves off the hook. And they're like, okay, well, we're not really that bad then. If this was a lesson, then we're not bad people.
We're not really the villains.
We're just learning a lesson.
And that whole moment, you know, with Cornwallis, it goes back to the idea that Jeff, you know, gets the group into such a territorial fervor that it actually does them harm, because they don't do their tests.
Yeah, exactly. Once again, the group is like, it's all about us and this thing, and it's so important, and they all fail because they missed the test.
Everybody lost. They literally failed the test.
Yes, they literally failed the test.
And I don't want to jump to the end too fast, so just remind me I said that so I can make a point later.
They failed the test. Well, I mean I don't know about you all, but I do think that the group learned their lesson, and I do like the winger speech that we get. I do feel like it's earned. Whether or not they always keep the same level of growth is a thing that you don't get in sitcoms, because they're sitcoms. Everyone's going to grow and then regress a little and grow some more and regress a little. They're not going to be perfect the next episode. But I did like that it wasn't just a speech, which Jeff tends to just do, is like speak and inspire or speak. They backed everything up with action, which was very important to me. Like, look, we actively have done harm. We can't just say, we're sorry, our bad, we've learned our lesson. They have to actively work to make the school better, which I think that was an important thing to see, was them actually doing stuff.
Yeah. I forget when they started. Was it the Save Greendale Committee in season 5?
Season 5, yes.
So I felt like there was like an early little like foreshadowing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I actually quite like that speech, and I especially like the sentiment behind that, because it's something you see a lot when people get caught into a nationalistic fervor of, you know, oh, this is our place, we can't let them in, it's mine. And it's like, well, if it's so great, that should be something that you want to share, so you can let people see why it means so much to you, how it's affected you, and it shows the group, you know, not be so possessive of this place. That, you know, has been highly influential on them, but actually, you know, maybe try to share it. You know, I know Annie and Jeff aren't a big fan of the MCU, but Asgard's not a place, it's a people. Yeah. So
yeah. Thank you. Yeah. You said it, so I didn't have to. Thank you. Exactly.
And it really does tear down the whole idea of nationalism, because, you know, nationalism is just a glorified version of territoriality.
Yeah.
And they become less territorial by the end of the episode.
Yeah. And they actively are making what is not great about the place that they exist in better, because they realize again that they kind of have, well, first of all, they definitely do have positions of power. Dean Pelton loves them. They have a good thing. They have the study room. Of course, everyone wants it because it's good, because it's better than what everyone else is suffering through. And instead of saying, I'm so sorry you're suffering through that, like, I'm going to share my space with you, which would have been fine. Like, that's not terrible of a lesson. But I think the better lesson is that the group is actively trying to make the place that they, that other people exist in, better, because they realize it is not all about their particular space and their particular room. They've seen what other people endure. And when you are able to actually see that, then they've managed to develop empathy for that. And empathy is more than just like feeling that, it's actually acting and doing something about it. And so I like that, because it would have been fine to end the speech with something really inspirational, but like for them to actually like change, help other people's, help make other people's spaces better, it's a nice way to show that the group actually is growing, because they're backing up what they're saying with action. Because we're all used to hearing platitudes and nice, well-meaning things, but like, what are you doing about it? What are you doing to change this? What are you doing to make it better? And so you can see that the group actually is like, oof, we need to actively work to make Greendale better for other people, not just
us. They have a heightened awareness of what Greendale is, because obviously, you know, the study room and the table is a familiar focal point, and it's basically a sitcom trope, obviously. When they're forced to go to a crummy place, they understand eventually, you know, okay, Greendale is not just about the study room. It's a whole place with a whole other people other than us. And they have to endure some really crappy stuff. So let's just make the whole place better. And so just a really good, and you are, I'm just only adding to what you said. I thought it was really good, but again, I think it's a great, metaphor, I guess, of how things can be in the real world. If you never have to experience, you know, the destitution, you know, of places that are not your own, you can't have empathy. It's always in theory.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Well, we've reached the part where I have to begrudgingly talk about a storyline in season four. So sorry, guys, this is technically a part of this episode, and you will technically hear me talk about this story as the show progresses in season four. Changnesia's a thing. I don't know. Anyone have any thoughts on the whole season arc about Changnesia or this particular Dean and Chang storyline? I got nothing.
I actually love Changnesia.
Whoa.
I just don't think that it ends well. I felt like I felt like it was a great setup and a lousy punchline. That's my feeling on Changnesia. Because I think I like every episode with it. I like it here. I like the initial appearance. I like the whole, you know, documentary episode on it. I just think, it kind of sucks that they had this great little gag that they unceremoniously drop later in the season. And it's like, okay, that was a funny joke. I wanted to see where you were going with it.
And they were like, nowhere.
It's one of the reasons I don't like the superhero episode that much, except for the pop gag. That was pretty great. But like I thought it was a good gag. And you know, I like that it kind of played up, you know, Chang's little habit of inserting his name into everything, which is something that the Dean also does.
Yeah, I know. They are fun to, like, I mean, Jim Rash and Ken Jeong are really funny together. Like, I would never normally begrudge a scene with them. I was just like, I literally, before I press play, forgot that the story existed in this episode.
So did I. Yeah.
I was like, dang it.
I was not a fan of Ken Jeong until I watched this show, because I only knew him from The Hangover.
Yeah.
And I think he had a really bad part in Transformers 2. I think. Wasn't he in Transformers 2?
I did not see Transformers 2.
Well, you're not missing that at all.
I feel like I wasn't.
and then I watched this show. I'm like, oh, this guy's actually really goddamn funny.
Yeah.
So I like Changnesia. I just think it's an example of a great setup that, you know, was really funny to me that they didn't deliver on. And that's the thing I don't like about it, is that you didn't build it up to a good conclusion, and that sucks.
That's fair.
I hated it.
I can be
objective. I thought it was just like the weirdest choice ever. And again, it's like the actors are great.
Yeah, exactly.
I just about them. Couldn't get behind it. And I was like, there is absolutely no way that Chang has amnesia. There's absolutely no way. This is not a trick. He literally took over the school and was literally like the dictator. Yeah. He had like, it was, which is one of my favorite episodes.
We know, we know it was bad. And we're like, but I don't, I think for me, and I've talked about this before, like I love season one Chang. I think season one Chang was the best utilized Chang. I like season two is fun. Season three gets a little wonky. Basically from here on out, they don't really know what to do with Chang as a character. And you can feel that, especially in season four, where it's like, you have Ken and is a series regular, but like, what do we do with him? Right. And how do we pull back from what we did in season three, which was so over the top and wild. And I do not care for that story because I was like, you guys went way too far. You can't pull it back from here.
One of the reasons three would have been a great final season.
Yeah, exactly. I feel like, it was hard to like go, okay, I can see where he would be like, you know, maybe getting a little bit of power is an interesting thing. Like, because, you know, he didn't have any power in season two. Now he gets power. But they took it to a cartoonish villain place that I was like, oh, there's no way you can pull back from this episode.
And once again, I'm going to be like, I loved what they did in season three. Like, and when you go back and rewatch, you can see, and this is what I like, is that you can see where it starts, where his his breakdown starts.
For sure.
And you can follow it. And it's like, even in the episode where they're doing the dance off, and he's waiting for the group to come, but they're late.
Yeah, season two.
And it broke him. You can see the progression. And it was absurd. It was definitely absurd.
For sure.
But I mean, I'm sorry. I loved it. I'm just saying. So again, I loved Chang in season three. I thought season four, it was just so weird.
Yeah.
So weird.
That's my main qualm with Changnesia is like you went so hard in season three that
they had to erase it.
You really wrote yourself into a corner, which is, again, if the show would have ended in season three, would have been fine, because you know what, whatever, like we're done with it. But like, how do you undo that in a believable way? And the only way that they could undo that in a way that was like, I guess, the most believable was faking Changnesia and making this thing up, which it was just kind of like, okay. But in fairness, I do not like, I love Ken. Ken is great. He's one of the nicest human beings I've ever had the pleasure of talking to. But I feel like, and even Ken said towards season five, he was getting to the point where he was like, what is this character doing?
What am I doing?
And like, he told Dan, like, what is this character doing? And I could feel that. And you can feel the seeds of that in season four. Mm-hmm. And it kind of starts to keep getting that way as this show goes on. But
I kind of wish, and maybe this is, sorry, just real quick, just wishful thinking. Okay. I wish he had stayed the Spanish teacher.
Right. I wish every year, this is my pitch, if I could go back and rewrite it, there'd be a lot of things I'd do differently maybe, but he would just randomly teach a class every year because Dean Pelton needed someone and didn't care if he had qualifications or not. It's like, this year he's the driving instructor. You could find a way. It's a school.
And yeah, and as a class called ladders. All right,
it's a school, and you're telling me there's no way you could figure out how to make him a teacher the entire time? I thought he was best utilized when he was being more of an antagonist to the group, and it was funnier.
And didn't want to be one of them. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. So, Eric, what were you going to say?
Yeah, like it kind of adds to the idea of him becoming part of the group. Yeah, he, season one Chang is definitely the best Chang.
Yeah.
You know, Senior Chang. Because you can't say Senior Chang after after season one, but that truly is the best Chang. But the one thing I will give credit to with the Changnesia plot is you do kind of see him, you know, make that transition to a character that is not a foil to the group, but a part of the group. And it is something that, you know, it's one of the examples of follow through when it comes to season four, where that is something that carries over to seasons five and six. So I do kind of appreciate that. I just don't think the punchline was delivered terribly well at all. They just dropped the joke, which is my big problem.
Yeah, which, you know.
I think if they had a better payoff, people would be more fond of Changnesia.
Maybe. Yeah. I think it was just kind of the lackluster payoff of a lot of stuff that happened in season four, just kind of petered out. Like I really do think that season four has a lot of great stuff. And I think that where they faltered was like, they kind of just didn't connect or didn't keep things leading into season five because of uncertainty. So they kind of just half resolved some stories that just,
which is something the first three seasons do extraordinarily well. They not only tie entire seasons together, they carry stuff over from finales into the, like, the premieres of the next seasons.
So. Yeah, which is fair because, like, I mean, who know? They didn't know what was going to happen after season four. And let's be real, Dan kind of undid a lot of stuff that happened in season five. They're like, oh yeah, gas leak here, which I am not fond of but I do appreciate that in season five's premiere, Jeff says we can't blame it all on the gas leak here. And that is where I will say, thank you. Problems did not start with the show in season four. They happened before this. So, well, this was Alternative History of the German Invasion. Do you all have any last thoughts before we ask our final couple of questions?
I just want to point out some things, if it's okay. I have a list.
Oh, I love lists.
This is not the whole, this is not, this is all my notes. This isn't the list. I like the little nods to the previous World Wars throughout the episode. I know you didn't like Professor Cornwallis. I think it's, first of all, I think it's hilarious that he thought that Greendale students would know what Cornwallis meant. So he's like, I know what you're all thinking. And yes, it's like, we weren't, nope, that's not us.
Nope.
But when there's this amazing cut and the scene just starts with him saying, and that failed ventriloquist was Slobodan Milosevic. And it's just the most perfectly delivered line with the hard cut. And it's, of course, it's supposed to be like Hitler was the failed artist and maybe we wouldn't have had the Holocaust. And it's like, I just thought that was, it was just the most random, absurd, like Slobodan Milosevic, like what? It's so great. During Oktoberfest, I love that Britta got the Blutwurst and Little Munich, which I'm sorry, stuff like that just makes me giggle because it's like really Little Munich. When the dean banned the Germans, he mentioned that they were banned from water fountains and swimming pools, which was a really interesting nod to Jim Crow. And also, of course, he says, you know, that's why I keep a detailed list of every student's race and nationality to prevent racism and nationalism. And it's like, okay, but again. So I just thought it was
the fact that it's just so backwards.
It's just, you know, all these things peppered through. Like I said, you know, like when Troy was like, when Troy told Abed he was just following orders, or when the security guard was like, do you have a sign-in sheet? Jeff's like, you're asking for our papers. It just, things like that. I mean, without it, the episode would have been funny, but it wouldn't have been like a delight. And I thought that the episode was just a delight because of all those little things sprinkled through.
Yeah, this is one of my absolute favorite episodes of the fourth season. I think a very underrated episode. I think a great continuation of the foosball episode, and I think a great moment of self-realization for the characters. And I think it has something valuable to teach. You know, you can criticize, you know, maybe the execution or maybe the jokes aren't that funny, but there is a valuable statement here about, you know, get outside your bubble, you know, look outside your city, look outside your country, look at the people around you, you know, in the cities around you and the countries around you. And, you know, try to empathize, try to look at how your actions affect people, and maybe you just walk in someone else's shoes and try to, I'm not saying this well.
No. You're saying it great. It's true.
Really feeling it.
I mean, yeah.
just get outside your bubble. Stop putting up walls and fixing your own castle. Try to fix what's outside your castle too. You know, don't try to hog all the wealth. You know, if you feel that you live in a position of comfort and privilege and you're worried about losing it, well, don't worry about losing it. Feel sad that others can't enjoy those same things and try to make the world so that they can enjoy those things. Mm-hmm. I think that's a good lesson.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. I agree. Make the world better by learning how to empathize with others. And that starts by looking outside of yourself. But also, Eric, like you said, self-evaluation of like, what privileges do I have that others do not have? And how can I actively work to make the world so that other people also have the same rights and privileges that I do? Uh-huh. Work to make the world better, everyone.
That's your charge.
It's super easy. It's real easy to do. We figured it out. We've solved the world's problems. But it's silly, but it starts with that and then figuring out how to build from there. But a lot of people aren't willing to even start there. So if you're just unsure, just go outside of your, well, I mean, maybe not go outside as we're recording this. COVID Delta variant is just a hot mess across this world. Maybe don't go outside, like, but look outside of your own.
And thunderstorms. Don't forget
and
thunderstorms.
Yeah, and thunderstorms.
Yeah. Really, so just Google.
Google, figure out what organizations you can support that are doing good in the world. We'll talk about that a little bit later with our like last plugs, but that is your charge, fellow Greendale human beings. And it's been so fun to have both of you here on today's episode. Thank you so much for joining. And we're going to wrap up with our last couple of questions. So our second to last question is always, what is one piece of media, either a book, a TV show, a film, a podcast, et cetera, from either a Black or Indigenous or person of color creator and or featuring Black men and women, Indigenous people, or people of color that you would like to encourage our listeners to consume this week?
My current favorite movie of all time, it's been my favorite movie for over 20 years now. It's called Eve's Bayou.
Ooh, Chelsea's gonna like that because I've heard talk about that.
it's just everything, the cinematography, the story, the acting, the atmosphere, just the script, the direction, you know, the period, you know, costumes, just everything is perfect. And it's set in, I think, like civil rights era Louisiana, which is like a place of like history for people like me who, you know, who weren't there. It's like, ooh, it's the bayou, you know. But it's got Samuel L. Jackson in it, Lynn Whitfield. It's got a very young what's her name, Megan Good, and Journey Smollett.
I know.
And I think I'm saying her name right. She was maybe not even 10 yet, and she deserved an Oscar. Mm-hmm. She should have gotten an Oscar for her role. Some of the emotions that she portrays, you can't direct a child into that. I know people say like, well, good child actors are really just good direction. And there's a lot of that that's true, but she did it. She did it all. And that just makes the movie, it's just the cherry on top. You have to watch Eve's Bayou. It's perfection.
Oh, love that. Okay, so I am going to recommend something that by the time this is out, there will probably be more episodes, if not the entire season. But I checked it out because I was on Hulu and I had heard good things. Reservation Dogs, which is an FX on Hulu exclusive series that is entirely cast and created and written by and directed by Indigenous people, which is super cool. That's like, it's groundbreaking for that. So it's about these Indigenous teenagers who are trying to get out of the town that they're in. That is their goal. It's like a dark comedy, the first two episodes I've watched. So it's like, it's really, really good and deep. And I can tell that they're going to do a lot with these characters, these young teenagers that you meet. And they all have very distinct kind of personalities and reasonings for wanting to leave. And I'm really excited because it already has hooked me in two episodes. And so I like sitcoms, but I also like to, you know, these kind of darker walk the line of drama comedy shows are also intriguing to me. So you all should check that out. Like I said, as we're recording this, only two episodes are out, but I have a feeling by the time this drops, you can watch the entire first season. So there is awesome. That.
All right. Well, me, I'm a big fan of horror, love horror. And, And Jordan Peele has been one of my favorite directors to come out in the last couple of years. So he's got a couple of projects coming out that I'm really excited about.
Yeah.
There's the Candyman remake, which he produced, yes. which looks amazing.
Yes.
Wait, it's going to be directed by Nia DaCosta, who is also going to be directing the Captain Marvel 2.
Awesome.
Yeah. But not just the Candyman remake. Peele came out with a teaser poster for his next movie, which is just called Nope.
Yeah.
I want to know what.
I think that's what everyone on the internet was like, I want to know what this is about. Because isn't the poster just like a cloud? And it's like a cloud hovering over like a field, and it just says nope.
Yeah, it's just like, and you're like, and just what's like happening? And just like nope.
You're like, of course.
I'm gonna be there opening night.
Yeah. Oh, love.
It kind of makes me think of the joke about how Black people react to like folklore. Like they don't even go there; they just go nope, and they turn around and they don't get killed. Because they don't even engage. So I hope it's something like that.
Yeah.
But we'll see.
Which incidentally, and this is a movie that Jordan Peele actually mentioned when he was talking about, you know, horror for people of color, was a very underrated film by Wes Craven called People Under the Stairs. Either of you ever see People Under the Stairs?
I'm not a horror person, but that's, yeah, no, I have not.
So. It's one of Wes Craven's best films. It's also one of the best leads who's a person of color I've ever seen in a horror film, which the actor's name is Brandon Adams, and he plays a kid who is dying of a kid that's treatable, but they don't have the money to get the treatment, so he decides to break into his landlord's house, money just to get treatment for his mother. But then he breaks into his landlord's house and he finds out that his landlord is a cannibal that has a bunch of kidnapped kids in the basement. And it's been doing a whole lot of horrible stuff. So it's basically a reverse of Home Alone. The kid breaks into the house and he finds out, oh my God, I'm in a crazy house.
Ooh.
And it's a really great movie, has great social commentary. And the lead character, played by a wonderful actor named Brandon Adams, who was in The Sandlot and played a young Michael Jackson in Moonwalker.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. See, he's the main character. And he's awesome. He is so cool. That kid is my hero. So,
I know the feeling.
Excited for the Peele movie. And let me plug People Under the Stairs. Nice. Very underrated film.
Cool. Well, thank you both so much for being here. And before we ask our last question, I want to give people the chance to find and follow you and promote your stuff. So Eric, why don't you tell people where they can find and follow you?
Currently, I have my home at Screen Hub Entertainment. It is a little blog I run with a couple of friends of mine. We just do articles on, you know, pop culture news, film analysis, all that good stuff. And we have content that comes out weekly. So yeah, check us out at Screen Hub Entertainment. We got a lot of new content coming out.
Nice. Sherry, where can people find and follow you?
The safest place is
I also like to say, yeah. Where do you want people to find and follow you?
The most, for all ages place. No, I'm kidding. It's that sounds worse than it is. I'm not going to give you my Twitter handle, but
yeah,
I'm a photographer as a hobby. So I have a website. It's studio281.net. The 2, 8, and 1 are the numbers, the digits. Right now it's a little bit under construction because I'm kind of rethinking it and trying to engage with my audience in a different way away from Instagram. But like you said, by the time this comes out, it'll probably be ready to go. So studio281.net, that's me.
That's so pretty. Sorry, I literally was googling it and I was like, let me check it out as we're on this show. I was like, it's so pretty.
The look on your face, I was like,
so pretty.
Did I say something wrong?
No, we'll link to this in the show notes so that people can see it. I'm like, oh, it's so pretty.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So Well, as always, you can find and follow us on Twitter. We are at COMM Rewatch Pod. Follow us on Instagram at Community Rewatch. Check out our pinned tweet, which is always our pinned tweet, and donate if you're able to the Loveland Therapy Fund for Black women and girls, because we believe that mental health access is important and not everyone has the ability to have access to mental health resources. What's really cool about the Loveland Foundation is that they pair their Black clients with Black therapists, and that's really important. So go check that out.
Awesome.
And finally, since this is a Community Rewatch podcast, I always like to ask people, what's one thing you're currently rewatching, or what's something that you really enjoy rewatching? So, Eric, what do you really enjoy rewatching, or what are you rewatching now?
It's funny because Troy actually mentions it in this episode. I'm rewatching Burn Notice.
Nice.
I never watched that show. I saw so many ads for it. Never watched it.
Yeah, I got into it because I was a big fan of Bruce Campbell from the Evil Dead movies.
Nice.
And then I got into it and was like, oh, the rest of the show's good too. and went for 7 seasons. This will be my second time watching the whole series. And yeah, nice. It thankfully ends very well.
Good. Like that. Sherry, how about you?
Well, if I'm being honest, I've probably watched all of Bob's Burgers 8 times.
Oh, that's why I never watched either.
In the last like year and a half.
It's been like
10
I said,
seasons.
It's been, we've said the last 2 years have been 10 years. So really that tracks.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah. And I just happened to give it a chance. I don't think anyone necessarily recommended it. I can't remember, but it's like my comfort blanket. So nice. I had to wean myself off, this year so I could do some other things. I will be back. But I also recommend Parks and Rec. Again,
love.
Without Parks and Rec, I probably wouldn't have found Community when I did. So that's definitely rewatchable.
Love that. Well, I am basically always rewatching New Girl. Everyone who listens to this pod or knows me knows that that is the case, but also I have finally found the emotional bandwidth to rewatch the 2 seasons of Single Parents that exist, because they were created by Single Parents was an ABC sitcom created by Elizabeth Merriweather and JJ Philbin, aka people who also worked on New Girl. And it had Taryn Killam and Leighton Meester and Brad Garrett and Kimberly Lewis, and it was so good, and it was tragically canceled, and I will forever be mad at ABC because it ended on a cliffhanger. And so
don't you hate it when they do that?
I hated it so much. I was like, you gotta be kidding me, man. Come on, renew the show. And they did not. So it's on Hulu, so I enjoy it. It's a delightful comedy. Every time I kept finishing Hulu shows, it would be like, do you want to watch the Single Parents pilot? I was like, no, I just be reminded that it's over. But I finally decided to rewatch. And,
hey, that's what fan fiction's for. I mean,
no,
live it. Just live it. Right. Make it come alive.
But I actually think I'm going to, before the next season comes out, I think my next rewatch will be AP Bio, because I did quite enjoy that. So I will probably end up rewatching that. So, well, thank you both so much for being here. Thank you, everyone, for listening to this episode, and we will see you next time. Thanks for listening to the Community Rewatch podcast. We hope that you enjoyed today's episode. If you did, be sure to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts these days so you don't miss an episode. If you want to follow along with our content on social media, you can follow us at COMM Rewatch Pod on Twitter or at Community Rewatch on Instagram. Many, many thanks to Chelsea Eichels for putting together today's episode. We're so glad that you chose to go back to Greendale with us. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.